It's a delight to see so many people in attendance today, and in respect of your time and in respect of the reason for your coming here, we're going to go ahead and start the program now as you continue with your lunch, please. We are very excited about having such a large crowd today, which tells me either the three organizations have exactly pinpointed a topic of great interest, or in the post-holiday spirit, all of you recognize a bargain. Here you get three speakers for the price of one. But one way or another, it promises to be an informative, if you will, mini-seminar. And each of the presenters today will also have information posted online, so you'll have an avenue to pick up some notes or to be in contact with them. And I think each of you maybe got a little slip of paper with those URLs. My name's Jerry Bryan. I'm pleased to have the easy part of the job, and that is the song and dance introducer. And I get to present the speakers, and then they do their thing. We're going to be talking about topics that obviously are of some interest to you, where you want to embrace new tools, make use of them, because I'm sure you understand that your choices are you either control change or you get controlled by it, and you've chosen to be proactive. And don't let it bother you if you're not up to speed on all these technologies. If someone with gray hair can get into the field, you can too. Jump in, the water's fine. Transforming technologies, that's the title that was used for today's meeting. And you know, those tend to be disruptive technologies. They go beyond increased speed or increased productivity. And they're concepts that change the way we do things. Now, they're not necessarily ideas that replace current methods. They might be additive, and in fact they usually are. If you want to think just briefly of the evolution from handwritten messages to printing to the more modern tools of telegraph, telephone, radio, television, photocopying, faxing, and then on to the information era with the internet, the web, email, digital media, and then the ones we're talking about today. Now, you notice that the old tools remain in use, prominently in use, with the result that you have an increasing number of delivery vehicles available to you in your daily work. And many of you are thinking, yeah, that's why I'm so stressed out. Well, let me give you the good news side of that. That's a good thing. Back when I was covering the legislature, we used to refer to certain pieces of legislation as the Lawyers and Accountants Relief Act. Anytime a new law is passed, it creates more jobs for lawyers. Anytime there's tax reform, it creates more jobs for accountants. Guess what these new communications tools do, folks? There are clients out there, there are organizations where you work, who are in need of guidance and assistance, adapting, using, benefiting from, and avoiding the pitfalls of the new technologies. And that represents opportunity for you. So today we're going to discuss additions to the list of tools in the quiver. We're going to be talking about blogs, wikis, RSS, and podcasts, and there are some relationships between them. And our panelists, thankfully, will define those terms for you and provide examples of how they're being used. And then after their presentations, we'll have a little time for Q&A. But they'll try to anticipate your most pressing questions. If I want to use these tools, what are the steps I need to take? And should I jump in on my own, or should I partner with a consultant or a vendor? How do I get started? I'll just offer you one tip up front, just as an information resource. If most of you limit your thoughts about online research to say, oh, I can Google that, add one more to it. I can Wikipedia that. If you do not go to wikipedia.org, you're missing out on something. Go there. In days gone by, someone leaving the home in the morning might check to see, do I have my calendar in my suit pocket or in my purse? Today, I check Palm Pilot, iPod, cell phone. And just the times change. And I'm using my iPod now, the newer one with the videos. I try not to watch those while driving. And I would recommend you do the same. But the tools are there. You will be using them. And now it's time for us to learn just a little more about them. I'll briefly tell you about our three speakers today. You'll learn more as you listen to them, and you'll learn more as you go to their their URLs later for information. Our first speaker will be Tony Calandro, who is a vice president of Fleischmann Hillard. And Tony spent some time in D.C. with the political scene there and with Blue Cross in that part of the country. And when he came back to Fleischmann Hillard, he's been actively engaged in forming online alliances for a variety of activities, public affairs, community relations, grassroots, lobbying. And all these online activities do have that component where you can reach your audiences for a variety of means. Tony will be speaking to us first. The second speaker after Tony will be Steve Mays, who is a vice president of Learfield Communications in Jefferson City. And for those of you familiar with Learfield, they cover quite a bit of territory by way of statewide news network, farm news networks in multiple states, and carrying the athletic broadcasts of a number of major universities. Steve was on the news side and then more recently into the online and internet activities with their clients. And Richard Callow, whose company is Public Eye, and who is in charge of a website called MayorSlay.com. And he will inform you that that is somewhat different than Mayor Slay the Mayor over at City Hall and MayorSlay.com, two different things. And it gets into the subtleties of how you communicate and why. Those are the three speakers. Without further ado, I'm going to ask Tony Calandro to get us started. Tony?
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks for having us all. Before we start, we kind of want to get a show of hands to see where the audience is. Raise your hands if you've posted to a blog before. And do any of you have your own blog? Okay. All right. Well, I am going to talk a little bit about the what's going on in the communications environment that is producing what I think is a revolution. Talk a little bit about the tools that's fueling this transformation. Give a little bit of statistics to counter the idea that this is just a passing fad. And then talk a little bit about what it means to all of us in this room. So I wanted to start off with, it is a very different world today, and if you can't see the caption underneath the dinner table, it says, well, yes, we could read your blog, or you could just tell us about your school day. Now, that's got some significance for my family. I've got a 10-year-old daughter who has a blog, and she wants to podcast, and her mom does not. And so we have some interesting conversations around the dinner table, but it really is a different world today. So what's different? Well, a couple of things. One, the consumer is fed up. Technology has gotten easy, and I always tell people that, you know, I'm not a technology person at all, and getting into this environment, if I can do it, then anybody can do it. Broadband fast connection to the Internet has reached critical mass. More than 140 million people in this country have a fast connection to the Internet. And the Internet is no longer a static medium. It's a dynamic. And so top-down communications no longer works. People want to engage and they want to participate. And really what we're talking about is a consumer transformation is going on. And in this reality, the engaged consumer views a relationship with a company organization as a partnership. They want to be engaged with a company. They don't want to be talked to. They want to be told about the problems and what's being done to handle them. They'll be more loyal to companies that engage them in a conversation. And just as importantly, they share their experiences with their peers, friends, and neighbors. And so we get this asked a lot, why should we care? Well, there's a lot of reasons, but two important ones. 44% of all U.S. Internet users have contributed their thoughts to the online world, whether it's a discussion group, a blog, a vlog, podcast. And just as importantly, consumers are 50% more likely to be influenced by word-of-mouth recommendations from their peers than seeing any TV commercial or radio commercial from a company about a product. So what's fueling the transformation? Blogs, I'll talk about briefly about three things. Blogs, RSS feeds, and podcasts. And I'm sure most of you have heard of blogs and are familiar with them in some degree. But blog is short for a weblog. It's a regularly updated online journal that links to stories and studies and other blogs across the Internet. Bloggers write from a personal perspective. They share their experiences or their opinions within their communities of interest. But most importantly, they are trusted networks of peers. And what makes a blog credible? Well, there are several things. One, they gain credibility by the perceived subject matter of the expert, the number of links that link to it, the ability to first publish new information. Bloggers want to be the first ones out there to publish the information. And then it's also written in a conversational tone that makes it seem a little more approachable to the reader. And there's no spin, total transparency. And to give you an example, this was a post by Robert Scoble. His blog, The Scobleizer, he's a software, for those of you who don't know him, he's a software technology guy at Microsoft, and he blogs about all things technology. And he has done more to put a human face on Microsoft than Bill Gates will ever do. And this was the first post that really sort of gave him some credibility with folks. Why are blogs important? They break the traditional news cycle. Gone are the days that, you know, news is in the morning and news is in the evening and you read the newspaper the next day. News is 24/7 and blogs are fueling that. They also respond to the news cycle and will extend the legs of a story. But there's a couple of points here, but I think, to me anyway, personally, the most important aspect of this is that it really, for the first time, provide consumers with the same platform, communications platform, that was once dominated by government, business, and the media. And going back to Scoble as an example, there was, and I've got it on my blog, there was a post today by an organization that analyzed the web presence of Scoble versus all of the big PR firms in the country, including mine, Fleischman Hillard. And Scoble, by leaps and bounds, had more of an internet presence than all leading PR firms. So when Jerry talks about that this is a disruptive technology, it is indeed, and it doesn't know any boundaries. But again, consumers are fed up, and consumers have got the ability to now to have an equal perch as all the other entities. Blog growth. When I saw these statistics, I was sort of blown away by it. But in 2003, there were 200,000. In 2004, there were 2 million. In 2005, there were 9 million. Technorati, a search engine that monitors blogs, believes that there's about 275,000 posts a day, 11,000 posts every hour, of blogs created in this country every 7.4 seconds, and 62 million people regularly read blogs every day. They're being used by companies and nonprofits in a variety of ways. It's a source for real-time feedback. Frank Lutz with GM has got a blog, Fast Lane, and he unveiled yesterday the new Camaro design and got instant feedback, both good and bad, on the new Camaro. So it's a source of real-time feedback. You get an idea of where the market is headed. We've got clients that are using it for thought leadership, product branding, and rumor control. Client of ours, Visa, is an Olympic sponsor, and they are targeting this blog towards predominantly college kids. And what they've done with this blog is they've allowed any athlete in the Winter Olympics trying to make their country's Olympic team to blog about their journey. And so they give them the opportunity, the tools to blog about it. It gives readers an opportunity to go behind the curtain and see what it's like, and to see what an Olympic athlete goes through to make their country's team. And so it's a way to bring the user closer to their world, and I think Visa recognized that. The power of blogs derives from RSS. And RSS stands for really simple syndication. But basically it's a way to get internet content when you want it. It allows you, you never have to go back to a website to check on content. It gets delivered directly to you. And if you publish content, it's a way to use the internet as a distribution network to send out your content to other consumers free. The elements of RSS, if you've seen any one of these icons that's on a website or a blog, that's where you click on to register to receive that site's content. RSS also enables podcasting. Podcasting is derived by combining the words iPod with broadcast. Think of it as TiVo meets the internet. It's the ability really to listen to content or to watch video content anytime and anywhere you want. There are 22 million Americans today that have an iPod or a similar portable digital device. And the Pew Internet folks believe by 2010, more than 56 million people will have some type of a portable device. a client of ours, the NCAA, recognized that they've got to connect, do a better job of connecting with college kids. And so a very conservative, very siloed organization decided to begin blogging. And they've got a chief blogging editor who's a kid right out of college, and he is marketing the AA zone through iTunes, through MySpace.com, places where college kids go, young kids go for news and entertainment. We also hear a lot, well, you know, blogs is just a passing fancy. Today it's blogs, tomorrow it'll be something else. So today it's blogs, tomorrow it's MoBlogs. And MoBlogs is a mobile blog through a handheld device or a cellular phone. But to us it represents, you know, these are three, they represent something larger and going on in the communication industry. And to us, those are irreversible trends. And one is the control and authority of mass media will continue to diminish, while at the same time, the democratization of power and opinion will continue to increase. Google said this year that at the end of 2005 that there were more web pages produced by consumers than there were by mass media this year, and that will continue to increase. And consumers will continue to have a greater ability to participate in and influence issues and events. And then if you need further proof, I will leave you with a few statistics. By the time this session concludes, more than 700 blogs will be created, 16,000 new opinions will be posted online, 18,000 new users will have gone online for the first time, and 94,500 cell phones will be purchased. So what does that mean to us? A lot of things, but monitoring the internet now is a requirement. You just need to do it. There are four search engines that we would recommend that you take a look at and go back to on a regular basis. They monitor blogs: Technorati, Ice Rocket, Feedster, and Bloglines. Bloggers are as influential as mainstream media now. There was a clip a couple of weeks ago where the press office of the White House invited five chief bloggers to come in and get information before mainstream media did. That's happening a lot with our clients, too. We'll set up a dinner with chief bloggers as opposed to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. It's really bizarre to go in and talk to a client about, you know, you really need to have a relationship with Tree Hugger on an environmental issue. So, I mean, it is a new day. Search engine placement, you know, type in some words on how you think your issue is being described or your issues are being described online and see where your website pops up in a search engine search. Many times we find that a client's website is here, the discussion is over here, and they don't know the discussion, the folks over here doesn't know their website that has a lot of good content doesn't exist. And then from a PR perspective, the one thing that we would recommend, too, is that you've got to begin to build relationships with consumers and not just talk to them. Find out who are your significant influencers online and determine how best to approach them. And then if you're a large company, you might want to think about developing some type of an employee blogging policy. The law right now is really murky in this area. And it's just as much for your company or your organization's protection as it is for your employees. So it's been a pleasure here. I look forward to the questions. Thank you very much. Now, I think you've got the information out there, but I've got my presentation on this blog, and I've got some links and some additional resources on there afterwards.
Thank you very much, Tony. To be sure you understand a couple of points about things like a blog is a website. You might do it as a standalone blog. You might do it as a blog off of your website. The double-edged sword there is be careful when you're asking people to post comments and so forth. If it's aligned with a product where you can't stand the criticism or the heat, But a blog is fantastic to help showcase and expertise and build a following. By the way, just let me give you one quick example that I came across just yesterday here locally, the website for the Contemporary Art Museum in St. Louis. If you'll just Google that, get their URL, you'll notice the upper left-hand corner, there's a link to both their podcast and their blog. And when you link go to their podcast, and you'll find the same thing on BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. When you go to the BBC site, which I think is bbc.co.uk, but I'm not positive of that, on each of those, on the BBC site and now on the Contemporary site, when you click for their podcast, you'll find a nice description of what is a podcast, how do I access a podcast. And if you put one on your site, you'll need to explain that to your public so they'll know how. And so you'll want to be involved in that kind of information presentation. And you'll want to keep in mind that if you do the kinds of material that Tony has just talked about, authenticity is the key. People are looking for unvarnished information, not self-serving. They'll just unsubscribe. If I were, for instance, a local company like a Monsanto, I probably wouldn't do an RSS feed of my corporate profile. But I might very well do an RSS feed about what my scientists had to say about certain aspects of nutrition. Must be something the audience wants in order for them to subscribe. Now let me present a fellow who's been down this trail and who is dealing exactly with those folks who subscribe. Steve Mays of Learfield. Steve?
This is fun. I'm on a iPod timer here to make sure I don't go over time. I was talking to the other presenters before. Next time you guys do this, you need some people without reading glasses and gray hair. There should be some. And one other indulgence here as I get started. The last time I was in front of this many people, it was the high school production of Music Man. So I'm going to get one shot. Great. I'll burn 30 seconds of my 12 minutes, a little bit about Learfield Communications. You may not have ever heard of us, but we do collegiate sports marketing for some of the largest universities in the country, Missouri, Indiana, Iowa, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Penn State, Wisconsin, Alabama. We just picked up Army, Clemson, and a bunch of others. We operate news and ag networks in half a dozen states in the Midwest. We are mainstream media, sometimes disparagingly referred to as old media, traditional media. All of those things scare us a little bit. We're talking about disruptive technologies here. Our company's been around 30 years, and the next couple are going to change all of the rules. My topic is podcasting. Tony asked about how many bloggers. Any podcasters out there? Anybody? Yeah, there you go. Anybody ever listen to a podcast? Now, I don't count a podcast listening to it sitting in front of your computer in your den or your basement. How many of you have got, a lot of you got iPads. How many of you are listening to podcasts remotely, out away? Okay. I think that's an important distinction, and if I've got time, I'll get into it. I tried to find some stats on who's listening to podcasts, and I don't think there's any real good data out there. The most recent I found was by a company called PodTrack. They surveyed 1,000 web users. One-third of those said they had heard the term podcasting. That seems low to me, but I'm sort of immersed in this. Among that group, 32% have actually listened to a podcast, and 78% of them are men. So it's, podcasting would seem to be a guy thing if these statistics are correct. Let me take a stab, too. Tony talked about RSS, and you can't understand podcasting unless you understand blogs, sort of, and you can't understand blogs unless you understand RSS. If you go to 20 websites a day, and maybe 10 of those have something new on them, well, when you magnify that by 10 or 100, it gets crazy. You keep going to all these websites, and if there's nothing new, you've wasted your time. What RSS allows to happen is to tell your news aggregator to go out and check those websites, and if there's anything new, bring it there. Well, a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, somebody said, you know, I've got some audio. I've done an interview, or I've got some audio on my website. Is there a way that we could incorporate that in the RSS feed? And so podcasting was kind of born. So here's the situation. I go home at night. I slap my iPod and my charger. Is it back? Okay, what was it? You pop your iPod in. iTunes has already subscribed me to half a dozen podcasts. It goes out, pulls down those MP3 files overnight. If it sees that my iPod is connected, it goes ahead and it drops them in. In the morning, I get up, I come, I look, I go, oh, I've got some new stuff. The earbuds go in, I'm off to work, and I'm listening all day to this. Podcasting, let me give you a couple of examples of, I lost my timer here, so a couple of examples. We're working with Eli Lilly, which is a big multinational corporation, and they've got an animal health products division called Elanco. Elanco does all kinds of things. Elanco was interested in reaching swine producers. Now, I'll tell you, there's not that many really big swine producers in the country. I mean, they know who they are. They know where they are. They wanted to create some programming, some content, specifically targeted to those folks. So they came to our ag network, and we produce a weekly half-hour, you want to say radio show, but it's not on the radio. It is a podcast. And they have done a pretty aggressive job. They've provided iPods to these swine producers. They have sent people out to help them understand how this works. And the idea is to be able to really target this specific information to those folks and go straight to that very select group of people that they want to reach. They don't need to reach 100,000 people or even 1,000 people. They really only need to reach a few hundred people. And podcasting is an ideal way to do that. Another good example of a podcast and a blog is a company called AgWired. This thing is only about 9 months old. A former coworker of ours went off and started a little consulting firm, decided to start blogging and podcasting, very narrowly focused on the field of agriculture marketing, and he is quickly becoming the default destination. Everybody in that space is reading agwired.com. If you really want to listen to some great podcasts and watch how somebody is doing blogging really, really effectively, go to agwired.com. We're going to hear about Mayor Slay's podcast, and I went out looking sort of for other political podcasts. Talent Podcast from Missouri, U.S. Senator Jim Talent has one. There's some others. I really like what Mayor Slay's office has done. I was looking through some of the topics. You would go to one of these and you expect to hear some sort of position statement on Medicare or health reform or something, and all kinds of interesting topics, St. Louis hip-hop and an R&B holiday. He's getting some really good advice on how to use podcasting as a way to communicate. And then I noticed that Senator Talent had done the same thing. He had an interview with somebody with the Negro Baseball Leagues. So it's really easy to do podcasting wrong, but it's really effective if you do it right. I'll just touch on some resources. Anymore, you Google anything and you'll find everything you need to know, but certainly iTunes and the Yahoo Podcast Directory have some good explanations about podcasting. Podcast 411. Recently, I've been listening to Business Week's podcast. Heather Green does a weekly podcast about the business of podcasting. Excellent, excellent source for this. There's a site, and all of these, by the way, are on the site that I've set up too. Blogging for nonprofits. Beth Cantor is an independent nonprofit technology consultant. She's got a great set of links. Blog Write for CEOs had some excellent links on this point. And like I said, there's no shortage of these, and I've posted all of these online. I'll give you one. I know one of the things they asked me to talk about was, well, how do you produce a podcast? You don't need much, guys. I mean, you don't have to have a big studio. In an effort to sort of learn how all of this worked, I mean, I've been in radio for a long time, but I wanted to try my hand at podcasting, and so I looked around for a topic, and my family physician is just kind of an interesting guy. So I asked him if he wanted to try this. And so every week I sit down with a little inexpensive recorder and a couple of mics, and we talk for 30 minutes. I go back, I trim off the front and the back, I put a little music on the front and the back, I upload it to my website and post some show notes. Front to back, it's an hour. And we've been podcasting now for a few months. It's called livinghealthypodcast.com. And I use probably $700 worth of equipment. And you really wouldn't even need to spend that much. I've posted some things, too, about hardware and software online. You can read about that. You know, I would say to follow up on something that Tony said, and I think it's equally true about podcasting, organizations don't blog, and organizations and institutions don't podcast. I believe very firmly that people blog and people do podcasts. So as you get into this with your own organizations or as you advise clients in this regard, I think that's, to me, the most important thing. The person that writes news releases or corporate brochures may not be the right person to podcast. I would argue that they're probably not the right person. It's a different kind of writing and requires a different view of things. You probably have some bloggers in your organizations. They're probably deep undercover. I would put out some sort of blanket amnesty offer, tell them to come forward. These are the people that can best advise you, I believe, in these areas. You'll find a great passion and a great personal interest in this, and look for those folks and tap into them. And if you want to know whether you're doing blogging right, and if you want to know if you're doing podcasting right, I think the acid test is, are the people involved in it having fun? Now, I haven't written a lot of news releases and things, but it doesn't look like any fun to me at all. And the kinds of writings that a lot of you have to do isn't. Blogging is a lot of fun, and if you find that it's a chore or that they're not looking forward to it, you're probably not doing it right, or you don't have the right person doing it. Or maybe, and I tell people too, when they say, gosh, should our organization be blogging? Maybe not. If you can't go up on the high dive and do a cannonball into the pool on this with great enthusiasm and no reservations, I'd say you're not ready. Do not go down to the shallow end and tiptoe into this water. It just won't work. Be happy to answer any questions. Since I lost my timer, I have no idea where I am, so I'm going to stop now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. There's both Tony and Steve had made the point about you'll have people at your organization that might be doing some blogging and you might need a policy. You also need guts enough to tell the one person in the organization they're not allowed to blog, and that's your CEO. And that's a serious point. If your CEO goes online responding to blog comments or posting them himself, guess who's going to be in front of the Securities and Exchange Commission? Guess who's going to be writing a check for $600,000 to $1.2 million out of his own bank account, not the company's? It's a very serious matter if the CEO goes online and responds to someone with either a defensive statement or on the attack, and it hasn't been thought through by the PR people, the lawyers, and everyone else. It's very dangerous to expose your CEO that way. Okay? Likewise, if you have people in the organization that are blogging and it's known by management, then you know what a lawyer can do on the stand with that one. You know or should have known, da-da-da-da-da. And so there is some seriousness about that. If it's unknown to you that people are blogging, fine. If they're blogging and making comments about your company, be careful. One of my colleagues posted something the other day where he was having customer service problems with, I'll name the company, Hewlett-Packard, on some equipment. The next thing you know, it went up to, are you guys familiar with Dig? And it made a homepage of Dig, and Dig reaches every technologist in the world, and suddenly our servers almost went down. We were being bombarded by people wanting to read this post. And we were getting comments back, including comments from Hewlett-Packard employees, some apologizing and some saying, yeah, right on, we've really screwed up in our division, and here's what's wrong, and naming names. Now, that gets to be a little tricky, doesn't it? Okay? Here's my point to you about Tony and Steve's presentation so far. If you're thinking about getting into RSS feeds or blogging, the first thing I want you to remember is repurposing content. It's something you're familiar with. If you have existing content that people want, you can repurpose it. It's why the New York Times, BBC, CNN, and NPR, and others now do RSS feeds and blog and podcasts. They have the material. It's there. If I were working with a church, guess what? You've put a lot of time and energy into creation of a sermon. You've hired somebody full-time. They make the sermon available on the church's website every week. In the business, it's called Godcasting. Okay? If you are a public school, I would have multiple RSS feeds. Don't most parents go to the school website to find out the school lunch menu? I mean, I'm a little out of touch. My kids are grown. But if you do, why should you have to remember when to go to get the weekly lunch menu? Why shouldn't it just be delivered to you? So you would subscribe on the school's website to their lunch menu RSS feed. You might also subscribe to their soccer schedule RSS feed to keep you posted on changes in the sports schedule for your child. If you have content people want and that they automatically would want to come get, then you can think in terms of push technology, RSS feed or podcast to which they would subscribe. And if you put varnish on it, they'll unsubscribe. Now, that leads to someone who's dealing in a field where this would seem to be the most difficult kind of issue. How do you develop these kinds of technologies to serve the interests of an elected public official and not have people say, gee, I won't go there. Gee, I'm interested in that. That's a challenge. And here's a man who has helped meet that challenge, Richard Cowell. Richard?
I feel like going back to the office and taking my boss's blog off the site. The mayor was invited to give this presentation this afternoon, and he very much regrets that he could not be here because of a previous engagement, and he regrets that he sent me. I was the communications director for his elections in 2001 and 2005. My background is in survey research and political communications, and I have a lot of gadgets, but I'm not a techie. In 2001, Mayor Slay, who was then the president of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen, was facing a pair of opponents. One was a mayor, one was an ex-mayor. And the campaign, we learned from polling, was going to be about who was best suited to turn the city around. 21% of the voters, only 21% of the voters, thought the city was headed in the right direction. So our strategic problem was how to show voters, donors, and political writers that Mayor Slay was a better driver than his two experienced opponents. So the mayor sat down and he wrote a book, literally a book, about what he would do when he was elected. It had plenty of specifics, details about almost every subject. It was a beautiful piece of work. It weighed about a pound. Short of hiring camels and taking it door to door, we didn't have anything to do with it. So what we decided to do was this. We took the five most important parts out of the book. We cut five TV spots, put a bunch of GRP behind them, and then we ended each spot with a tagline that said, if you want to see the mayor's whole plan, go to his website. Then we built a website around the book. We added pictures, bios, and, of course, the TV ads themselves. Now, I don't know how many voters actually looked at that website, but I do know that donors did and political reporters did. And the mayor quickly gained the reputation as being the kind of guy who had a plan for the future. And meanwhile, his two opponents, who should have fired their pollsters, campaigned on their past records. Now, in 2005, technology and our understanding of the internet had grown some, and voter attitudes had changed as well. I mean, we learned from polling that voters were more confident about the city, and they had the general idea that things had been happening in the past 4 years. So we designed the 2005 website around a huge map of the city. You could click on any neighborhood in the city, and you'd get a list of projects, accomplishments, and public expenditures that fit the neighborhood you selected. Each click turned up about a million times more information you could put on a mailer or a postcard. And because all of the beef of the campaign was on that website. We were free to use our TV commercials as really good-looking infomercials about the state of the city, again with a reference to our URL for more information. But we had a plan in 2005, too. We hired an expert who would look at our website and tell us which people were looking at it, how long they stayed, what parts of it they read, and in what order they read it. Because we figured that this information would be useful if we won. Now, we had surrounded the heart of our website, which was this map, with video, with bios, with pictures, with contributor forms, with volunteer forms, with news releases, with volunteer links, and absolutely by accident, a blog. The blog was written by a young press aide who called herself Janie P. And we started that blog mostly as a way to amuse our young volunteers. I mean, she'd make notice of who was having a baby or who worked hard or whose project worked in the campaign, and she posted pictures of their accomplishments. She passed along their inside jokes. She got pictures of their pets, put them up there. And it took a little while, but we began to notice that the blog was having a far more profound effect in the campaign headquarters than we'd expected, and that its readership had extended well past our staff to our volunteers, to the donors, to the supporters, to the political establishment, and to the media. With her access to most parts of the campaign and her ability to post her observations day or night, Janie's blog became, in effect, the refrigerator door of our campaign, the common area to which staff, volunteers, reporters, and our supporters came any time of the day or night to see what was going on, to pick up on the dynamic of the campaign. And her refrigerator door was usually half a day ahead of TV coverage and a whole day, Kurt, ahead of Post-Dispatch's coverage. People began to ask the mayor when he went out when the blogger was going to get there. They'd go to the website after she left to see what she wrote and to see who else was there. And we began getting media calls about the issues that she raised on the blog and about events that she mentioned. And, you know, this was key for us. The number of people using the rest of our website jumped exponentially as people who came to read her blog stayed for the issues. Now, one of the things that any elected official looks for is a crowd. That's because it's impossible to meet enough people to elect you just going door to door, no matter how many doors you knock on. Finding a crowd is the most efficient way to communicate a message. All the people who read the Post-Dispatch are a crowd. All the people who drive past a billboard on 44 are a crowd. And all the people who visit a website is a really interesting kind of crowd for an elected official because it's made up increasingly of people who are never together any other place. Now, when he won the 2005 election, Mayor Slay asked me to recast the website, mayorslay.com, 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 for another purpose. Yeah. He wanted to speak directly to people, young, old, city residents, people who live in O'Fallon, about what he considered to be the city's strengths, its neighborhoods, its diverse population. And so we do that with weekly podcasts with interesting people, with a weekly poll about some subjects, with a weekly photograph of some interesting place or group, with a weekly cartoon strip which we've commissioned, with our own little news releases, which mostly take news releases we get sent from the airport and we cut them up and make fun of them, and with the mayor's own blog. We have not advertised the site, but it seems to be finding an audience. The number of people subscribing to the podcasts, the blog, and the news item increases every month. MayorSlay.com is currently averaging more than 9,000 visits a week, which translates into nearly 40,000 each month. That compares to an average of just over 9,000 in an entire month during our campaign, when, I might add, we had $650,000 worth of television behind the URL. Similarly, page views are trending upward. We're averaging about 2,500 page views each day, which translates into about 20,000 each week and more than 90,000 each month. The RSS feeds for the mayor's blog and the news are our most popular content, with each getting more than 8,000 views a month. And those are followed by the regular blog and the regular news section, which is each garnering about 5,000 views a month. That means that there are more than 13,000 views a month of the mayor's blog. The podcasts are downloaded more than 3,000 times each. The big picture, which is the photo essay, is viewed more than 2,000 times last month. Our polls are getting about 600, 700 votes for dull subjects about policy and about 5,000 votes for things like, should the mayor have an earring or should he wear jeans? The mayor says he's always surprised by the diversity of people who stop and talk to him about the website and the blog. He tells me that when he's on an airplane, people come up to him and ask him about it. And both major mayors' conferences have asked him to speak to their national groups about his blogging. Other bloggers locally pick up his items, and they discuss the subject among themselves. Reporters ask him questions at press conferences about things they read on his blog. But the mayor says that what really clinched this for him is what we learned about the blog from our own polling. On one of the many polls at MayorSlay.com, we asked readers what they thought about the blog. 10% of the respondents said they felt like they were sitting right in the mayor's office. 34% said they felt like they were hanging out on the same floor of City Hall where the mayor worked. And 40% said that they felt like they could see City Hall from where they were sitting when they read his blog. When you can get 84% of your readers feeling positive about the nuts and bolts of government, that project, the mayor says, is certainly worth doing. And so we do it. Thanks.
Wow, what a success story. Thanks, Richard. I believe that's located at mayorslay.com. Would that be it, mayorslay.com? A little while ago, I mentioned the idea of repurposing content. Richard's presentation reminds me of another little adage you probably need to bear in mind if you get into this area, remixing. You are not in control. Once you've put something out there, people can remix. Okay? They can download, they can remix. That's not necessarily a bad thing. You just need to be aware of it. For instance, if we took that example I pulled out of thin air earlier, that if I were at Monsanto, I might not do a corporate promotional piece as a podcast, but I might do my scientist talking about nutrition. Now I'm a high school teacher. I download that 20-minute thing from the scientist. I excerpt 3 minutes of it, and I make it available to my high school students, and I say, listen to that, and write a 2-page essay on that piece of it. Guess what happens? That high school kid then is talking to his or her parents and saying, wow, I found out some stuff about foods and biogenetic engineering you won't believe. Really interesting stuff. And as time goes along, that kid winds up with a favorable impression of two things, doesn't he? Biogenetically engineered products and a company called Monsanto. So it can work in your interest, but again, you're not in control because somebody else could excerpt that and then turn it into a Greenpeace commercial pushing back the other direction, correct? But we've known that before. Everything we put into print, everything we put online on our websites, can be excerpted. So can this. So just bear remixing in mind. It's one of the things that can happen. But it's also why podcasts have overtaken streaming audio. Streaming audio, I can point you to a URL, and you can sit and listen for 10 minutes, and then it's gone, and you have to listen to all of it. Whereas MP3 is a file. You download it. You can put it on an iPod, take it with you, and listen to it in the car instead of listening to a cassette tape with a self-help program. Or you can save it on your computer and listen to it later. Or you can remix it. Or you can email it to a friend. Or you can burn it to a CD. It's putting content out there for people.